You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if you offer us a plate of shit and try to convince us it's chicken, it's still chicken, and you're still an asshole. I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and what I was referring to there is a quote from David Sedaris in The New Yorker. He said, "To put them in perspective, I think of being on an airplane. The flight attendant comes down the aisle with her food cart and eventually parks it beside my seat. Can I interest you in the chicken, she asks, or would you prefer the platter of shit with bits of broken glass in it? To be undecided in this election is to pause for a moment and then ask how the chicken is cooked." We're in for a fun few months, ladies and gentlemen. And this is coming from somebody who's coming from the perspective of hashtag don't vote 2020. A lot of you know I didn't vote in the last election. I'm not voting in this one. I know South Park did back in the day, the, you know, giant douche and shit sandwich, and you're always picking between the two of those. And it was funny back in the day because their whole point was you should vote anyway. I think things have gotten a lot worse. And it's amazing to me that something like this is written in The New Yorker because someone is so far, so deep into his own echo chamber, into their echo chamber. That's insane to me. But let's get to our echo chamber. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Well, it's really really heating up out here in LA. We're actually above 80 degrees. Feels like it's the first time this summer. So planning on taking the dogs to the beach today and seeing how much I can get away with not wearing my mask at the beach before I get a, what is it, an $800 fine? What is it up to now? They're just keep increasing the fine until we can finally pass, what is it, 10-289, right?
Yeah, I didn't even know you were allowed to go to the beach in California anymore.
Well, I'm going to go.
I like the civil disobedience. It's very very Florida in spirit to go to the beach right now. Also joining us from the unnecessarily expensive woke capital of the country, the voice of Trailer Takedown, whose race you'll never be able to figure out, so stop trying, you fucking collectivist, Dan Hackney.
Good to be here again. It's nice to be the backup Dan when the regularly scheduled one is on indefinite paternity slash, I guess, book leave. And we've definitely got plenty of racially ambiguous things to discuss, so it's even better that I'm here this week.
Maybe I should rename... I was going to call this the Identity Debate Edition, but maybe I should call it the Racially Ambiguous Edition. I don't know. Which is better? Which is better?
we'll decide by the end of the show.
Yeah, we'll decide.
We'll figure it out. Okay, well, let's get into it then. Let's do it in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
If you want to support the Midside, you can always do so through our Patreon page or our Locals page. We've had a bunch of people switch from Patreon to Locals. If you're more comfortable with that, that's fine. That's why we have both there for you. Locals makes us a little bit of cancel proof, I think. And honestly, if everyone switches to Locals, we would just get rid of Patreon. But there's still a bunch of you on Patreon right now, too. So any support, you know, if you want to give per episode on Patreon or per month on Locals, we appreciate it. You can find those on themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/locals.
I already switched to Locals.
Yeah, you're one of the bunch who switched to Locals already. We've had a bunch of people. And it's a little disconcerting when I keep seeing the Patreon numbers drop. I'm like, man, we're doing terrible. But then I immediately go to Locals and I'm like, oh no, that person just switched. So... All right, first story. Let's get to it. You know, we still have a pandemic going on, or so we're told. And there's been a lot of developments recently in the past few days. I think the big one was New Zealand, right? Did everyone see what happened in New Zealand?
Yeah, they've been having an uptick again.
Immediately locked down again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found it a little bit of... I couldn't help but have some sense of poetic justice that they were sitting there all smug and, oh, we've done everything perfectly, and look at you dumb Americans, can't do anything right. And they have an uptick. Obviously, it's, you know, bad that people are getting sick and dying, but the seeing the smugness combated a bit, it was a small silver lining, perhaps.
Well, and that's a thought to hold on to, because that's where I want to build to with this. Now, with New Zealand, I don't know what the numbers are now, but in the middle of the week, a family of four, not all four of them, but four members in a family, came down with COVID. So they locked down the whole country for like 3 days. Now, does anyone know what's happened since then? Have the numbers continued to go up or what?
No, I think the news, it kind of fell off. So I'm not sure.
Right. Because they don't want to tell us what's going on. And that's the point. The point here is this story, right? The story of what happened in New Zealand leads to this headline that I read, and I was horrified by this headline. Forced isolation may be the only way to stop resurgence of virus. And this, even that headline, Dan, that thought you had, that where you had to say it's bad and sad that people are getting sick and dying, that's what I'm talking about. So a couple quotes from this article. Flare-ups from Australia to Japan show that the world hasn't learned an early lesson from the coronavirus crisis. To stop the spread, those with mild or symptom-free coronavirus infections must be forced to isolate both from their communities and family. The failure to effectively manage contagious people with mild or no symptoms is a driving factor behind some of the world's worst resurgences. But lessons from Italy, South Korea, and others that have successfully contained large-scale outbreaks show that there's a tried-and-true approach to cutting off transmission. Move them out of their homes into centralized facilities while they get over their infections, which usually doesn't require longer than a few weeks. Okay, first of all, the idea of setting up a government camp where you're sending a bunch of people who are sickly or weak to, haven't we heard of that somewhere before?
Yeah,
that's terrifying to me.
Yeah.
That's terrifying. And then what's behind that is the real lesson, right? They say we still haven't learned the lesson. I don't think the lesson they're putting forward here is the real lesson. The real lesson is this is part of nature. This is part of reality. How can we socially engineer away from this? How can we hide from this? Why are we getting to the point where everyone is sick until proven healthy? Shouldn't it be, as I've said from the beginning, let people live life as normal, set up measures to treat people who get sick, and also protect the people who are most vulnerable? Why is it the extreme where we have to lock down all life and try to socially engineer something that's just a normal part of reality?
Yeah, Justin, I think I've been thinking a lot about this in terms of risk, right? And, you know, everyone has different risk tolerance, right? And this is really hard to talk about with people because they'll immediately go into, well, if you're an asymptomatic carrier and you're infecting all these people, we sort of have the moral authority to basically lock you up, right? Like that's what they're talking about, right? We have the moral authority to take your freedom away, right? And
William, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm going to let you continue in a second, but I want to drive this point home. That's why I said sick until proven healthy. It's the same thing as saying, well, you have potential to kill someone and you're guilty until proven innocent. It's the same concept.
Yeah. And I think it's really it is a valid question to explore, but the sort of rhetoric around this is basically if you want to say, wait a minute, are we really talking about, you know, this sliding scale of risk that has changed and morphed over the months since the since January, then you must want to kill people, right? But let's set that aside because I want to talk about this. The lockdowns were justified to flatten the curve, to make sure that we could not overrun our hospitals. And governments in the United States, UK, many other countries actually like forced other people out of hospitals, right? People didn't get treatment. You know, I'm sure there's tons more deaths for diseases that couldn't be treated, preventable things, because everyone was forced out of the hospitals. And we can talk about whether that was effective or not, or we could if we, you know, we weren't, if just talking about it doesn't immediately make you some sort of death monger or virus denier. So,
I mean, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'll be a death monger and a virus denier. I don't think the lockdown was justified. I don't think it was at all. I think here's the thing I look at with this, and I'm going to throw this to Dan. When I look at, Dan, the transmission rate, the death rate, the hospitalization rate, right? What I always say to people is the odds of contracting this is incredibly low. The odds of developing bad symptoms once you've contracted it is low. The odds of being hospitalized once you have bad symptoms, once you've contracted it, is low. And the odds of dying once you've been hospitalized, once you've contracted it, once you've had bad symptoms, once you've contracted it, is low. So when I see all of that, I say that this isn't justified. I think there's the potential that there is a plague or a virus or a pandemic that could be justified with lockdowns and such, but I don't think this is it.
Yeah, well, part of the difficulty is that it's such a variable impact on different people, you know, the young versus the old, the otherwise healthy versus people with pre-existing conditions. And part of the issue is you have this one-size-fits-all policy where we restrict the healthy by the standards of the most at risk, which, I mean, I don't have the figures off the top of my head, but for a long time, there were no deaths of anyone under like 12 or something. That might have changed recently, but certainly it's very, very small. So that would lead you to think, the same policy that makes sense for sick people, you know, people with pre-existing conditions over 80 might not make the same amount of sense for, you know, kids under 12. That's one thing. The other thing that struck me is, you know, I can see a legitimate role for government to quarantine people who are actively infectious. It's, you know, when somebody is sick, they're an objective threat to other people. How much of a threat, in what circumstances, it's difficult to say, but in principle, at least, that warrants, you know, removing people so that they're not a threat. But at the same time, there's a tension between that and just indefinitely locking down everyone. It's especially when you have asymptomatic people, it really opens the door for, well, we just have to indefinitely detain everybody because anybody might be sick. And how exactly you balance the legitimate purpose of keeping people from harming other people, which is the role of government, from we can just have indefinite control over all aspects of your lives, that's tough.
Yeah, I think it's it just getting back to that risk and that sliding scale of risk, you know. Yeah. when we had little information, when we weren't sure what was going on, when we didn't understand the like effects on different kinds of people in different states, states of health. You can kind of I can understand something like a lockdown. At this point, though, we have other countries that are doing other things, right? You know, Sweden does not have a lockdown. They're kind of in the middle of the death per capita, and they haven't destroyed their economy in the process, or you know, had a slew of suicide. So we have to examine this, and I don't think we'll be able to do it for years. We'll have to examine this in that light and say, well, hey, did this even work? Right? Did this even work? Like, not only are the justification for the lockdown currently constantly changing, the goalpost of whether this worked or not is also constantly changing and getting looser and looser, right? Initially, it was, hey, we're just trying to flatten the curve. And now it's, we're trying to stop the spread. That's a whole different thing, right?
Yeah.
And can be used to justify all sorts of other actions by the government. And that's not good, right? We don't try to stop the spread of influenza with lockdowns, right? And we also don't quarantine people with flu, like any old flu, right? There is some standard here, right? Some standard of danger that's important, right? And where Justin, I'm kind of with you on this. Like, I'm not seeing this standard being met currently. And it also makes you wonder, like, how much are we delaying not just the economic recovery, but getting something like herd immunity is just not possible if we're constantly in this state of lockdown, right? Every time we try to open up, like, what's the criteria for opening up? Oh, well, the infection rate goes down. Oh, we opened up. Oh, the infection rate went back up, so we better lock down in case we get a curve again. It's an impossible, right? Currently, it's engineered so that it's impossible to ever get out of lockdown. Now, I've joked around a few times. I know when we're going to get out of lockdown. It's November 6th.
Yeah, somebody asked me this week when I think this is going to be over. And I said it's either going to be over in November or early next year when there's a vaccine. In regards to what you're saying, William, that's something about the whole waves thing, right? First wave, second wave, third wave. And, you know, they say, oh, Florida, we have a second wave, right? Isn't it possible this is all just the first wave and we've engineered it into a second wave by forcing everyone to go inside? And then when they came outside again, they started getting infected? Whereas if we had let them all out at the beginning, it would have just been a higher infection rate to start. And I think there's a legitimate discussion to be had about the whole flatten the curve thing. Flatten the curve was just taken for granted as if that was what we needed to do. But let me ask you this hypothetical. What if without flattening the curve, more people were infected, but fewer people died than with flattening the curve? Oh, and let me put it this way. Fewer people died, and there was less economic impact, and life went on as normal quicker versus now where we're dragging this shit out, and we're dragging the infections out over time, we're dragging the deaths out over time, and we're dragging the economic impact over time. That discussion was never had. Yeah, and I think...
People are starting to do that. I'll hit that point after you're done.
Right. Well, what I'm about to say, I think we'll bring together what you and Dan both said, and I think it's an issue of principle. It's an issue of what is the role of the government, and the role of the government is to protect individual rights. It's not to ensure the survival of the species, or in another way, it's not to be utilitarian and measure the collective strength or weakness of the country. It's to ensure individual rights. We should individually be allowed to make that risk assessment. Now, as you said, William, there's a case where you're too much of a risk, so they can do things, right? But if you're healthy, even if you're 80 years old and you're healthy, you should be allowed to make that risk yourself. Risk assessment. We've strayed away from individual rights.
Yeah, well, part of the thing that stuck out to me about that article was, there seemed to be this assumption through it that there's one line of the naive approach of trusting people, this laissez-faire approach, where it's this implicit idea that, yeah, sure, freedom is this nice luxury when, you know, everything's going well and you can afford it, but when things get serious, that's when you got to put a stop to this whole freedom nonsense and really get things done. That, again, there's a question of, to what extent can you quarantine people? But the attitude of freedom's a nice luxury until you can't afford it anymore is just so backwards.
Yeah, Justin, you mentioned the economic damage. I know if you guys join our Discord, link in the show notes, you can see an article I posted about New York City is dead forever, and here's why. And the author lays out some arguments about how people, you know, the first wave of the pandemic, a bunch of people left. Then the riots happened, a bunch more people left. And now there's you know, Midtown is dead, right? Like, and there's no arts, there's no restaurants, all the restaurants are closed, like, permanently. All the things that make New York, New York, like, why put up with the high rent and high taxes, all that stuff? Well, it was a dynamo, right? Well, the dynamo's gone. And we're going to see that in a lot of places. I think L.A., we're starting to see it. Housing prices in the suburbs, in the Valley, and out in Orange County and Riverside, stuff like that, are through the roof. People are buying houses sight unseen. They're leaving. They're going to other states, buying houses sight unseen. And just getting out of the densely populated areas. And with this change in people's work and things like that, people are, you know, these dynamos are dead. And that's real destruction, right? There is a value to living in a densely populated area. And we're seeing that here. We've done lasting damage in the name of this. And that's real people's lives always changed, right? Real people's lives gone, not just dead from the virus, but dead from this. And not to mention what the effect this is having on the third world and the poorest economies, right? Like, this is possibly setting some countries back generations.
Yeah, that article, William, beyond talking about the economic impact making people move, I think there's a huge risk assessment that's done, as I was just saying, to living in a densely populated area. Why would you live in a densely populated area where, I mean, the famous thing is, right, the worst place to live if the zombie apocalypse breaks out is a city. And this is just driving that point home, where everything now, where communication is so fast, and basically the only thing we don't have to make life convenient is a transporter, right? That's why Elon Musk is working on something like the Hypertubes. But if you could live in Iowa and just do a transporter to a big city to work every day and go back, that would change things fundamentally, and people would do that. Because why would you live in these densely populated areas where you're putting yourself at risk? There's such a mix.
Interact with people. But if you can't do that anymore, then pretty much all of the value of these cities goes away.
But the other thing that goes with that, you know, talking about the economic, the interacting with people, that's such a risk to interact with people nowadays.
Exactly.
Because everyone, right, exactly. I think we're headed for a civil war, but that's just me. So very interesting.
You and Tim Pool.
I don't see how it can be reconciled. I don't see how it can be reconciled. We're now on Twitter. I see people calling themselves MAP, minor attracted persons.
Oh, God.
And they're using the same social justice rhetoric to defend having that inclination and saying it's the same. I don't see how these things can be reconciled. But
people,
that's a whole other discussion.
People are chain blocking people routinely now, even like non-technical folks on Twitter. A chain block is where someone insults you or you cry bully. Look that up if you don't know what that is. And then you just take that person's followers and you block all that person's followers.
Execute their family. Yeah.
So, you know, because of course, if you follow a Nazi, then you must also be a Nazi, right? And so they're
exactly.
Just further deepening that echo chamber hole, right? Like, they never have to interact with anyone outside. Like, that's really like fundamentally sad. Because Justin, I know you can identify with this, and Dan probably can too. I've never felt like I've been in a culture that I fully belong in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've always felt like an individual, and not in a bad way, right? Like, I'm not saying that in that sort of way. I've never felt this conformity. In fact, I've always felt quite uncomfortable when everyone is conforming, right? But these, you know, some of these folks are just, it feels like a cult to me, right? It's going from religion to cult.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the whole concept of the Midside is, right? But you're jumping ahead, I think, to the last story, because I think a lot of this goes into the last story. And
yeah,
the one point I want to belabor about what you said is, you said, you know, their logic is, well, if you follow a Nazi, you must be a Nazi as well. I will belabor this point until I am killed for saying it. What is so insidious about it is they're not calling actual Nazis. Well, the people they're calling Nazis are not actual Nazis. That's what's so insidious about it and why I think we're headed for a civil war. Because when people are that fundamentally disconnected from reality, there's no other resolution. But let's go to the next story.
On that happy note.
We could just end the episode there, really, right?
Yeah. The Everybody's Depressed edition.
Feds say Yale discriminates against Asians, white applicant, Asian and white applicants.
Or just Asian.
And white the rest applicants. Of us... only HAPA applicants have been discriminated. Do you guys know what HAPA means?
No, but I can guess based on the context.
Half Pacific, yeah.
Yeah, HAPA is a term. It comes from Hawaiian, but it's used in Southern California a lot. It's someone who's part white and part Asian. Yeah, so I think most people, when they heard this headline or read of this news, were like, oh, yeah, of course. Makes sense. But I'm going to read a couple quotes here. We have, the two-year investigation concluded that Yale rejects scores of Asian, American, and white applicants each year based on their race, whom it otherwise would admit, the Justice Department said. The investigation stemmed from a 2016 complaint against Yale, Brown, and Dartmouth. By the way, I think their use of the word scores here is poor writing, because I think they meant scores as in lots of. But it sounds like they're rejecting like their SAT scores. So I think that was like, poor word choice, poor diction by the author.
Maybe they're trying to be cute.
Yeah, maybe.
Scores and test scores.
Right. Don't fucking be cute in a fucking news article. You're going to confuse people. Prosecutors found that Yale has been discriminating against applicants to its underground program based on their race and national origin, and that race is the determinative factor in hundreds of admissions decisions each year. The investigation concluded that Asian American and white students have only 1/10 to 1/4 the likelihood of admission as African American applicants with comparable academic credentials, the Justice Department said. I mean, I look at this and I have to wonder, William, is this some actual good the Trump administration is doing?
Maybe, but I think it's fruitless. And the reason I say that is look at the objections that they're giving, and I agree with them completely. That race was the determining factor, and in fact, I think we may have covered the story a couple years back about the gentleman of Indian descent that wanted to be a doctor and they rejected him because he's Asian, and so he changed his haircut and name on his application, reapplied to look African American, and he got in.
Oh, and, no.
Yeah. Can you get that drop, William? That was great.
So yeah, this happens. This happens routinely. This is by design. But remember, here in California, we covered the story, in the before times, I think, about how they're trying to get rid of the restriction of government using race as a determining factor in hiring and school admissions. To them, this is moral, right? This is completely moral to do this. And it fits in the social justice religion to use race as a determining factor. Of course, if your skin is white, you're privileged. Of course, if you're Asian, you're doing too well, so we have to hold you back and give others the opportunity because they need it, right? It's the need over the justice, the concept of justice, right? And these other minorities need it because they're more oppressed, and we can only measure we have to measure their oppression, and the only way we can do that is by their skin color, not the only way. The preferred way to do it is by their skin color or national origin. I mean, what if it's a white person from Africa? I guess there they would say privilege, right? If it was South Africa, I think that because this fits in their moral worldview, this isn't going. It's helping in the sense that it's bringing this out and exposing it. But until people look at that moral premise of the oppression Olympics and reject that, I don't think this is going to help. All this is going to do is spur Nancy Pelosi to propose, you know, the repeal of the Civil Rights Act, right? I mean, that's, we've already seen in California.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that the people who once considered themselves the defenders of racial equality have in a way come full circle and are advocates of racial quotas and segregation. So, I mean, you can understand how it
is that
got
surprising
there,
though, because this is the Democrats, right?
Yeah, and in a way it's not, but it's just weird. And you take a step back and look at it and think, like, God, how it seems like with the same basic set of arguments we've gotten from don't discriminate based on race to we have to discriminate based on race with seemingly no sense of irony about it.
Well, Dan, it has to do with fundamental premises, and you've exposed something that I've always said and tried to explain, and maybe this will help me put a finer point on it. But it's the idea of once you understand things a certain way, you see the weird reverse logic of everything. And it's the same thing with selfless and selfish, right? Mm-hmm. We trump it around and we go selfish bad, selfless good. But when you understand, like, well, selfless actually means no self and you're harming yourself, you fucking go, wow, that's so obvious, but I never saw it that way. And it's because, and this is what you made me think of, it's because their rhetoric is so far removed from their actual premises that if you listen to the rhetoric, it's surprising. But if you know the premises, it's not surprising. And that's why you're like, oh, it's surprising. And William's like, it's not. Because it's not surprising if you come from a collectivistic perspective. If collectivism is your bottom line, well, then of course you're going to reenact racial quotas and segregation. Because you have to. Because that's how you divide people up. And even the way I just said it, coming from an individualist perspective, me just saying divide people up sounds fucking horrifying. But from a collectivist standpoint, it's not. But that's the unit of measurement. Yeah. It's the unit of measurement. That's it. So we got to get people in their separate groups, and we have to make sure the groups all have equal stuff. That's what you have to do. So it all depends on what your thinking is based upon, and that's unfortunately what we've lost in society, because we've lost the rhetoric of it. And William, on that note, that's why I was asking about if this was good the Trump administration was doing, because it seems like they're trying to put into law, and correct me if I'm wrong here, put into law and make it official that you can't be collectivistic in this way. Are they not doing that? Am I misunderstanding this?
No, the problem is it's already in law. And just to give like a brief history of this, so when I was applying for college, the University of Michigan had a decidedly illegal point system where people who were quote unquote underrepresented got bonus points on their like so many points scale, and they were using that as admissions. So basically the equivalent of the highest SAT score, that score, if you were black, you got those points for free. And that was deemed unconstitutional. So did colleges change and give up on this affirmative action stuff? No, they changed the terminology and they just started doing it anyway. They did it a different way. They started giving up objective scoring and started not having test scoring matter, right? They're basically just pulling it out based on other factors, right? Interviews, quote unquote, things like that, right? And we've seen this systematically put into every admissions in every college is done this way now, where it's completely arbitrary and based on your, you know, if you write a woke enough essay and have a black enough sounding name, then you can get in. I mean, we saw that with the Indian student, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the courts can throw all of this out, but the whole institution is set up this way, right? The whole admissions institution at every university is set up this way. This is what they are doing. And I don't know. None of the previous court cases have stopped this. It's that we can get another verdict that says that this is illegal, and then they'll just re-engineer it again. And because they want this outcome, they want that. Right. I think it's less than 50% of students are white at Yale. And that makes you kind of scratch your head a bit. Right. Because you're thinking, well, not that the Yale should reflect the mixture in like the general population of the United States, but you would think, wow, if we're getting top talent from all over the world, you would expect a little bit higher percent than that, right?
I mean, I'd expect a lot more Asians than anything, so.
Yeah.
But William.
And they're definitely overrepresented, quote, you know, quote unquote.
Not at Yale. Look, the breakdown at Yale, it's completely surprising, right? Like, you would expect, right, to see a lot of Asians, but you don't.
You're making my point for me, William. What's the only way this way end? This ends.
Back to this again.
I think for
the universities, an easier path might be just ignore them into irrelevance. They seem to be doing a pretty good job of that on their own anyway. Two things I found sort of interesting about this is, one, I personally was almost certainly the beneficiary of this kind of discrimination, which is...
Mute him, William. Just kicked off the show.
Yeah, we have to balance it out now on the show. Which is frustrating to think about, because then there's a question of, well, did I actually earn that spot, or am I the beneficiary of some attempt at racial balancing? Like, I want to be able to think that I actually got here by my own merits and not because people felt bad for people who kind of look like me.
Well, to interrupt you on that point, you're falling into the same trap as people who say are told they have privilege, where you are not morally responsible for your starting point. That is something that is irrelevant to your personal choice and your personal character. What you do with it is how to judge yourself.
Yeah.
And you have to define success for yourself. So your success or not would still be dependent upon you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But it's... The idea that I would be given things out of sympathy rather than my own achievement it feels icky.
Well, it does, but at the other hand, just give them the middle finger, because it's like they fucked up because they gave it to you who hates them. So it's like, thanks, suckers.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing, on a different note a bit, was, you know, these are private universities. I don't like that they're doing this kind of discrimination, but also having the government involved in telling them this I don't like that as a solution either. So I'm kind of...
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think the solution here, Justin, rather than fighting this out in the courts, is not civil war. It is to remove the government sanction on these universities. In other words, stop funding them. So if you institute, and I would say it should be punitive. In other words, Yale should have to give, you know, back all federal funds it received. All. Meaning all grants for research, everything. They should, the damages should be, you've violated this principle, then you have to return all of the money that you've received. And I think then
change their minds right quick.
Yale's got a giant endowment. If they want to do this woke admissions process, this deeply immoral collectivist admissions process, then go do it. But don't take money from a government that is supposed to be treating people like individuals.
Right, and then that goes to the even greater root problem, is how many people within the government, within the system in general, are trying to enact collectivism. So that then becomes the greater debate about that, right? Because I agree with everything you said, but if people within the government are okay with that, they're not going to do that. But the government has supposed to, the way it was set up, remain objective of these things and stay based on those principles. But then we have whole arguments about, you know, original intent of the Constitution versus living document, which confuses all of this.
Yeah, I think if we can remove this sort of thing from being a fight at the government level, then it becomes less important who wins in any particular election, because, you know, as it stands, who wins in the election decides, you know, college policy and, you know, all sorts of details of economic policy. And if you just unbundle those things, you just say, the government doesn't have to be involved in this, then it de-escalates the political process, which I think is to the good.
Speaking of government not being involved in things and de-escalating, did you guys hear that?
Yeah.
Wow, that's thunder. That's crazy. That is the loudest thunder. I'm literally in my closet with Bose headphones on. That is super, like, that shook the room. That's crazy.
I guess, wow. God is smiting you for these these stories.
Transgressions, yeah.
Or he's on our side. He's like, yeah, fuck the government. He was emphasizing that story.
It was a fist pump.
I used to think when I was a kid that thunder, I was like, what if God was bowling and he got a strike and that's what thunder is? Anyway, government not being involved in de-escalation of the political process. Trump's assault on the U.S. Postal Service gives Democrats a new campaign message. This has been one of the most fun developments of this election cycle for me, because it's absolutely hilarious to watch people bicker over this. So a couple quotes here. High-profile Democrats, from former President Barack Obama to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, sounded the alarm Friday about the president's move to denigrate government-run mail services, decrying it as an assault on democracy and the needs of citizens who rely on its daily deliveries. Trump said Thursday that he opposes both $3.6 billion in election aid for states and a $25 billion emergency bailout for the Postal Service because he wants to restrict how many Americans can vote by mail, part of a broader assault on mail balloting that he has repeatedly claimed without evidence. I love how this article had to throw that
evidence.
In.
Yeah, we have no evidence of mail fraud.
Would invite widespread fraud. The entire fucking election, this is part of why I don't vote. There's so much evidence of so much fraud on both sides in elections. Like, Jesus fucking Christ. Anyway, Trump, his family, and many top aides, by contrast, have regularly voted by mail themselves. I love that, too. I love throwing that in there. Is that valid for a news article? Is this an assault on democracy, or is Trump's concern about mail-in fraud warranted? And what I mean by that is, Trump has routinely been able to anticipate what the Democrats were going to do, especially now, right, where I read something, and I don't know if anyone else has read this, but you know, we have this idea that, you know, social justice warriors always project, SJWs always project. I saw an argument recently that people said Trump is going to steal mail bundles to stop the mail-in voting. What?
What?
This is insane. This is insane. I'm going to throw this to Dan first because he just made a noise. isn't this the same thing of, well, if the government doesn't make roads, who's going to make roads? Isn't this the same argument at this point?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a couple things to this. One is the U.S. Postal Service isn't the only organization that could possibly deliver mail. On the other hand, if his goal was actually to privatize mail delivery, the way to do it is to first repeal or invalidate or whatever the laws that prevent FedEx and UPS and whoever else from delivering mail, and then start defunding the USPS. But as it is now, if you defund the USPS, it's still illegal for anybody else to do mail delivery, so you've just reduced mail service.
Your use of the word defund just made me think of something really funny. I'm just imagining the protesters are out there and they're like, we said defund the police, not the postal service.
They both start with P. Ah, damn it.
Sorry, yeah, continue.
I think so. Is this an assault on democracy? Well, everything Trump does is an assault on democracy, right? So, sure. But I'm curious, with this in-depth, well-researched article, if they considered the fact that the Postal Service has been failing for years and has been asking for bailouts for years and has been on a mad decline with the invention of the internet and its, you know, package delivery services really being the focus of things, you know, they came up with that, the big innovation out of the Postal Service was the basically anything under a certain weight in a certain size box, you know, you can send that priority mail for a flat rate, right? Like, that was their big innovation a few years back. Other than that, nothing. And here's the dirty little secret. DHL, FedEx, UPS, they're all already delivering first-class mail, right? They're involved. They're subcontracted out from the Postal Service to deliver a lot of these this mail and packaging.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, do we need the Postal Service? Do we need this government institution? Probably not. Is this a move to, like, restrict mail-in voting? Maybe. But, you know, should we bail out the Postal Service? Probably not. And is mail fraud an evidence-free claim? Absolutely not. I had to dig up this old... I couldn't find it on HBO anymore, but I believe it was on Vice News. I know I did find the Vice article, but not the video of this. Just so it triggers all the right people. It was a GOP operative in North Carolina in a local election. Okay, so you might say, oh, well, this wouldn't work in a national election. But remember, all elections are local, right? In a local election... was charged and is the case is still ongoing, I think, from 2017, with ballot harvesting. Basically, they were going around picking up people's ballots and that you know, changing the votes, presumably, because the guy was a paid operative, right? Like, his job was to go into neighborhoods, and he didn't go into Republican neighborhoods. He went into Democrat neighborhoods, and he was manipulating the primary and the general and doing all this ballot harvesting. So to say that this is evidence-free is not true. The other thing is, too, and maybe this comes from my hacker mindset, when you want to change something, you don't necessarily attack the thing that has the smallest impact, right? Mail-in voting previously has almost no impact on the election. We completely disenfranchised tons and tons of military voters with their mail-in ballots because they don't come as fast, right? If you drop your mail-in ballot out in a fob in Afghanistan, it may not get there before Election Day, right? And we just completely don't care about that. But now, all of a sudden, if we're changing the way people vote, right? Like, the fundamental way people vote are going to be mail-in ballots. Of course, people who want to manipulate the vote are going to move to that medium. And we have to think, well, do we have a lot of defenses in place? I have a lot to say about the security of voting in general, but, you know, we've done some things at least. We have some safeguards in place. We have election monitors and that sort of stuff. Like, we have some things in place for the current voting system, the in-person voting system. We have almost nothing for mail-in voting systems, other than maybe checking the signature. And then what does that even mean, right? Because what if you just signed your name a little different this time than you did, you know, 20 years ago when you got your driver's license? Are they just going to reject your ballot? And then how do you know it's been rejected or not? And then how do you challenge it? What if the election's already been decided, right? What does that even mean? And there's tons of problems with this. And I think in that way, I hate to say it, Trump is right. To just flip the switch and do full mail-in voting is probably a pretty bad idea.
Well, in the same sense of what you were just saying of, you know, impacts if the election's already decided, could that be Trump's 4D chess here, where he knows last election they called it for Hillary, for Clinton, when she wasn't the winner? And could he be worried that if they do mail-in voting and the media does the same thing, people who would send in their mail-in votes won't otherwise?
I don't know. Who do you think is more likely to stay home? I think that's what the motivator is here. Who is more likely to stay home because of COVID fears? Republican voters or Democrat voters?
Okay, that's a much better 4D chess argument.
That's the 4D chess move here.
Right. The 4D chess move is that the left is more likely to stay home than the right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a good point. You Occam's razor to the 4D chess. So yeah, that's what Trump's doing. Okay, that makes sense.
Because I found the whole thing kind of confusing. Like, why? I've never voted in person, and unlike Justin, I have actually voted in, I think, all of the elections I've been eligible for? Maybe.
No, I voted back in the day. Yeah. I just didn't vote starting last election because everybody looked at the two choices and they're like, you got to pick one. I'm like, I don't want to look back if I have kids or I have to tell people in 40 years that I voted for one of those fuckers because they're both going to fuck everything up. And look what happened.
I just voted Libertarian, which, you know, there's a whole...
You voted for Pat Buchanan that. Accidentally.
Accidentally, yeah. But yeah, the from both of you, that's a very good point, because before this, I was just like, why is Trump going after this? Like, what's... It seems like such a weird, random thing to try to attack, but I, you know, at the risk of reading logical intent into Trump's actions, which is rarely a good idea, the issues you raised, William, make it... I take it out of the realm of just completely bizarre and into, well, there might be some rational justification here. Is that what Trump is actually basing it on? Who knows?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I think he's 100% basing it on that the left is more likely to stay home, especially because I've already seen the argument out there from people on the right that, oh, you're too afraid to go to the polls, but you'll go out and protest and riot for Black Lives Matter.
I actually am slightly, call me a Nazi, I'm slightly sympathetic to that. If you can put on a mask and go protest Black Lives Matter and talk about how important it is, and then every year we preach to the young people how important voting is, it's one day, right? Take some precautions. Put on your hazmat suit and go vote.
No, the right hits a good argument every once in a while. But then they'll sit around and they'll sit around and they'll yell, "Oh, you're hypocrites!" Right? That's their favorite thing about the left, where they'll call them hypocrites, and it's like the left doesn't care; they know they're hypocrites. Speaking of which, Joe Biden named Kamala Harris his running mate, and if you saw some comments from her this week, there was an interview with Stephen Colbert where Colbert was like, "Weren't you on stage in a debate calling Joe Biden a racist and an abuser?" And she just says back, "It's a debate," as if somehow that makes it okay. But if you tell her that, she doesn't care. You can't call them hypocrites. So with Kamala Harris being nominated, of course, what do we have to talk about, Dan, with her being nominated?
Her race.
Jesus fucking Christ. So this article from Vox: "The Kamala Harris identity debate shows how America still struggles to talk about multiracial people."
Who's debating her identity?
Lot of people, apparently.
Jesus, I mean, this article was so long. It was so long. And I picked out three quotes, and I'm going to read them. But there were so many quotes I could have picked out about this article. But I picked out some just to give you all... to save you from reading this article, because this article is so long. It's so long. These quotes are representative, so you can get an idea of what they're thinking. And then I'm going to make a point, and we're probably just going to throw this to Dan, because I think this affects him the most personally. But I think it affects us all personally, and that's the point I'm going to make. "While some South Asian voters are upset that this part of her identity has long been downplayed..." Okay, so she's Blasian. Blasian is black and Asian. I personally, just a personal thing, I think Blasian girls are fucking hot. Not Kamala Harris, I want to be clear about that. But just in general. Anyway. "While some South Asian voters are upset that this part of her identity has long been downplayed, others are excited about the historic nature of her nomination and what it represents for South Asian American women and women of color." I love how they differentiate between that, right? South Asians, they aren't color. "Meanwhile, some black voters are debating whether she is truly black enough." She's fucking... punch yourself in the face. Punch yourself in the face. No one asked if Obama was black enough. She's fucking crying. I want to be on this council, guys. I want to be on the council who goes around and is like, white enough, black enough. Nah, you're Asian.
Yeah, but are you Asian enough?
She's, at least the Native Americans have the good sense to have tribes with councils that decide whether you're part of their tribe or not. You just go to the council and they're like, yes, no. Like, just fucking do that. Jesus fucking Christ. This makes me so angry. I'm sorry. and far-right critics have already begun pushing birther-style arguments, questioning whether Harris is a U.S. citizen and her eligibility for vice president. Wasn't she born here?
No, the secret space robot Nigerians smuggled her in a 50-year-long scheme to overthrow... Yeah, it's nonsense.
Jesus fucking Christ. Right. Growing up black in America is also a very different experience than growing up Indian in America. Yes! Every person has a different experience growing up in America. Growing up in the world is different for everyone. And yes, as I said before, I won't ever say, you know, your race is different, is irrelevant to your experience. I won't say I'm colorblind. That's just part of life. As Indians have frequently benefited from model minority stereotypes, the false belief that Asian Americans are smarter, harder working, or more successful than other racial and ethnic groups. I love how they've created this label that they're using to make people feel bad about working hard and being successful.
Well, that's
having
white.
A stable family.
That's white.
Well, that's what I mean.
We saw that in all those woke books, right?
Right. So if you're a minority who acts that way, you're just trying to be white. You're trying to be the model minority because you're trying to act white.
Yeah. It's the assimilationist perspective. I've been reading the book How to Be an Anti-Racist. I'm disliking it less than I would have thought, but we can get into that later. But one of the...
Mute him again.
One of the viewpoints that he brings up and criticizes in opposition, as being in opposition to being anti-racist, is the assimilationist idea where, oh, these different races need to assimilate into the melting pot, basically, and then everything will be okay. And that's, in his view, that's just another form of racism.
Fuck him. All right, because they actually say something similar to that in this quote. It's a trope that the model minority thing is a trope that has been used as a racial wedge between Asian Americans and black Americans. As if just because they're not white, they should be on the same side and agree on everything. How fucking racist is that? Anyway, continuing. Last quote here. Carol Boyce Davies, of course she has a hyphenated last name, a professor of Africana Studies at Cornell University. Jesus fucking Christ, can I just bang my head against the wall? Africana Studies at Cornell University. Fuck you. Told Vox that the pressure to choose an identity is something uniquely faced by black Americans with immigrant families. This is where I'm going to push back, Dan, and this is where I'm going to make a point that I think is going to speak to you. Is uniquely faced by black Americans with immigrant families. No, it's not. Fuck you. Stop invalidating my experience. This is a good time for Americans to think through this question, and particularly since it's not raised often in the context of white immigrant identities. Fuck you. You don't know what you're talking about. White immigrants just pass and fade into white identities, and nobody knows what their background is. Fuck you. You don't know what you're talking about. The pressure to choose one identity over the other, as Boyce Davies said, is often put on black subjects or subjects of color, where people feel you don't have full allegiance to one identity, when really, we are all a complex set of identities. This is to me, somebody looking at white culture from the outside and not understanding how white people interact with each other. I myself... And I don't talk about this often because this is a perfect example. And Dan, this is what I'm going to throw to you. When you think of me as Polish and Italian. Why? Because that's the sides I talk about myself from. But did you know I'm also French-Canadian? Yeah. And did you know I'm also English? And when I say English, I mean like they say my grandmother's a mutt. She comes from all of the United Kingdom, right? I don't talk about these things. Why? Because I've judged my personality... And I've chosen which I identify with based upon my personality and those cultures. First of all, my last name ends in ski, so I can't really get away with not saying I'm Polish. So anybody who fucking complains that their last name affects how people see them, try having ski at the end of your fucking last name. Try that for 2 fucking days and see what happens. Oh, I as a teacher can't pronounce people with African first names? You want to try and have my fucking students pronounce my last name? I say, just call me Mr. L. Don't worry about it. But I identify with Polish for that reason. I also identify with Polish because that tends to be like my more sort of scientific side when you look at, you know, the history of scientists who come from Poland. And then I identify with Italian because I look Italian. I also look Polish, though. You know, when I was in Germany, our tour guide was like, I would have thought you would have lived here. If you didn't say anything, you would have looked like you fit right in. I could have fit in Poland. I could have fit in Germany. I could fit in Italy. You look at pictures of some Italians. I look like that. I tan very quickly like an Italian. And also, you want to talk about art and being a romantic? How do you not think of Italy when you think of romanticism and you think of art? So I tend to identify with Poland and Italy because I like those cultures better. And it seems like more of who I am. So you're going to fucking sit here and say that I don't pick that way? And, you know, my family, who three of my four sets of grandparents immigrated here in the mid-20th century, you're going to say immigrants didn't affect that? You think my dad, you know, his mom was 100% French and his dad was 100% Polish? You think there wasn't fucking integration concerns there when they got married? And my grandfather on my mom's side is 100% Italian and then married my grandmother, who, like I said, is the United Kingdom mutt or whatever. You think there weren't integration concerns there? This article, Dan, and this is what I'm going to throw to you, seems like it's incredibly racist against white people, turning a blind eye to the history of America, but it also seems to be dividing us based upon white versus minority, based on a lie that we all do have this shared common experience in America of defining our own identities individually, and they don't want us to believe that, and it seems to be just dividing us, and I find that incredibly offensive.
Yeah, well, that's all really interesting to hear. I have a very different experience growing up and identifying with racial, ethnic groups, whatever, is that it was never something I even thought about except for brief moments when I'd think, huh, I'm not any kind of stereotypical anything. That if you try to put me in a box of, oh, he's a, you know, computer science nerd, well, also I was on the varsity wrestling team and, you know, sang in the choir. Well, maybe he's a stereotypical wrestler. Well, no, I, you know, like, you know, I'm also a nerd and like playing computer games and board games. Well, maybe he's a, you know, stereotypical black guy. Well, no, because, you know, these other, like, there's no box that you could put me in. It never occurred to me that fitting into any kind of box like that would even be desirable. So it's not even, for me, it was not even so much that, oh, I have these different, you know, ethnicities or whatever that I have to adjudicate between which I want to identify with more. It was just, well, hey, I like wrestling, so I'll do that. And, oh, hey, I like, you know, painting Warhammer miniatures and playing those with my friends, I'll do that. And without any regard for connecting with roots or, yeah, they, one of the things they described for Kamala Harris was that at some point she decided to lean more into her black identity over time. Like, I hear people say things like that, and I have no idea what that actually means.
Makes me want to throw up in my mouth a little bit. Can you imagine me leaning into my... I can't imagine myself leaning into my gay identity, right? Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. It's like, what does that even mean? I am me. So, I am this unique individual. And, like, what would that even mean?
Yeah. Like, would I go play basketball and listen to hip-hop music? Like, isn't that just perpetuating the stereotypes?
I think I'm psychologically incapable of watching Drag Race. So I don't think I could ever lean into my gay identity.
I'm definitely psychologically incapable of watching Drag Race. But I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm making a point about the difference between race and culture and choosing your own identity. And I don't want to make it seem like my primary is, in my primary growing up, was choosing between those. But it's something you think about.
which cultural things you want to integrate into your life. I think that's really important, right? Like, there's tons of... A lot of folks that lean more objectivist identify very strongly with, like, ancient Greek culture or Renaissance culture and art, right? And I think your point is spot on, that it's the cultural things that you identify with that inspire you, that connect to your personality, connect to your worldview, your sense of life. Those are the things. And we each get to choose our identity. And I hate even using that word, because part of it is discovering your identity as an individual. I can't remember, where I got this from. I'll have to look it up, and I apologize for that. But someone recently was making a point about, and using sort of, like those traditional circle diagrams to kind of illustrate it. In this view, this sort of identity view of things, this very Marxist identity view of things, and putting everyone in these bubbles of stereotypes, in their minds, they sort of imagine these bubbles with very little overlap between groups of people, right? And instead, in reality, what we have is all these things are very similar. Like, even when we look between male and female, right? Like, take any random characteristic, personality, height, weight, all those things. The actual similarities are closer than the differences in the group. Now, when you look at two individuals, that's when things can get really skewed, right? If we put a randomly selected male against a randomly selected female, they're going to have a lot of things in common, and they're going to have a lot of things that are very different. But when you start aggregating those differences, they average out and they come together. But that's not how the social justice view sees people, right? This is sort of like it's not necessarily an argument for treating people as individuals, but it's looking at it in a unique way, that this is why the unit of the individual is so important in thinking about relationships and difference and similarity, and not the group which they belong to, whatever circle you've drawn around certain characteristics and decided that is a group. And it's when you look at this and basically saying, well, I'm deciding which circle I'm in because which circle I'm in matters more than who I am. That's, I don't know. It seems really destructive to yourself, right? Because I'm not the group. I am not the group that I am a part of, or even the group that I choose to be a part of. I am me. I am this unique individual with unique experiences and my own thoughts, independent thoughts.
That's why, William, I wanted to distinguish between what I was saying about picking culture. Because I was never picking a group. I was picking a culture that I identified with. Like you said, I was starting from myself. And I think what you're saying speaks to something Dan said and speaks to something you said earlier on the show, that it's an experience I share as well. And I wonder if it comes from us being such staunch individualists, even from a young age, in a collectivistic culture. And what I mean is, the mid-side is about, never being part of the in-group or the out-group. Just being there, not identifying with anything. And I've never really identified with anything. Something Dan said, I identify with greatly. The idea that I was a wrestler, but I was also watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Or I'm on the bus, we have an away game for a soccer game, and I'm reading a Star Trek book, Star Trek Deep Space Nine novelization. And kids are looking at me like, you shouldn't be reading on the way to the game.
That and
the coach...
fit.
The coach had to tell them to stop because people prepare in different ways. But I never felt like I was in any place. And that's why someone like Snyder appeals to me, right? Zack Snyder, because he's exactly, Dan, when you say the wrestling thing, I immediately thought of him. Because look at the nerdy stuff he loves, right? He thinks like us, but then he also lifts like I do, right? And honestly, seeing someone like him made me more okay going to the gym. Because I didn't want to go to the gym and be harassed by people like that. But now I don't care as much. And what I wonder, William, is this sort of disaffected feeling we have is what I was saying to Dan at the beginning. They're dividing us by trying to make us think our experiences are different, by telling us we have to fit into a group, when really we all share the experience of trying to discover who we are as individuals. And ironically, they always talk about empathy. Wouldn't we be able to have more empathy for each other if we actually looked at each other as individuals than as members of a group?
Yeah, there's no such thing as group empathy.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that strikes me is one way in which I can see this, oh, she's South Asian, so, you know, the South Asians will want to vote for her, is purely as a defense mechanism. If other people are identifying based on race and make that a really important thing and mistreating people as a result of that, then in a way you're kind of forced to, you know, if it's a battle of collective versus collective, you kind of have to band together as a collective to resist that. The problem is there's an alternative to that entire system of just don't ascribe characteristics to people or identify them together based on this superficial identification. So
I think the antidote is a little deeper too, just to put a bow on it. It's that it's okay to look at groups and draw conclusions, but you have to throw them all out when you speak to an individual. And actually look at the individual, right? That's the thing that's the step that their sort of moral premise throws away, and not just throws away, but calls racist, right? We're supposed to look at white people, right? We're not supposed to look at William or Justin, right? But when we see these actual individuals, you can't just draw the conclusion about how privileged they are, right? You can't just draw the conclusion that they suffered racism. We don't have collective experience. We have individual experiences.
Well, and that's what they're to ground it in the subject. That's what they're doing about Kamala Harris. It's not about judging her as an individual candidate or not. It's she's a woman. She's black. She's South Asian. So ironically, these people who are being told they should vote for her for these reasons are harming their own self-interest. They're not looking at what she stands for and what she would enact if elected.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Biden were to die or step down.
Even the question, is she black enough, right? Because now we have this ideal blackness, right? This circle we've drawn on this collective. And is she black enough is the question, because she shouldn't be able to claim this identity if she doesn't have the right, quote-unquote, kind of experiences, the ones that we want this circle to represent.
Well, at the same time, complaining that the negative experiences of this group are an injustice.
Go ahead.
That, you know, there's all sorts of injustices done to a bunch of black people, which, yeah, there are. But unless you yourself have suffered those injustices, that somehow excludes you from the group, rather than saying, like, hey, cool, you managed to escape the injustices. Like, you lived the ideal that we should all hope and strive for.
Yeah, and it gets back to the leader stuff that Justin brought up, right? Like, or that you brought up. You know, we have to elect someone who is black to protect our interests, rather than saying, oh, what has this individual done, right? What is their behavior? What is their ideas? What is their platform as an individual, right? Like, why is it written somewhere that only a black person can handle, quote-unquote, black issues? And in this case, I actually mean the individual issues that the voters care about, right? Like, why does the skin color change how they can enact whatever policies that you want to enact?
Well, and that's what I was going to ask, is the assumption that if you tick the box of black enough, then you will automatically do what is beneficial for the black enough community?
Well, that's what the representation means, right? Like, I think
that's the assumption.
Yeah, that's I guess that's the assumption, the service assumption, right?
Seems insane to me. So
it is.
Does anyone have anything else to say about this article or this topic? It seems like we've hit a natural stopping point.
Can't wait to vote.
Don't vote 2020.
Just screaming into a pillow forever.
Don't need to know about your personal life. All right, what did we learn this trip? Dan?
I learned that I should live up to my stereotypes so I can better connect with my identity, except that stereotypes are bad unless I'm connecting to a racial... I don't even know anymore.
William?
I learned that Drag Race would be psychologically damaging to both Justin and I. Another thing we share. Justin, what did you learn?
I mean, the existence of Drag Race is kind of psychologically damaging for me. But anyway, that's a different discussion. I learned that, woo, Civil War! That sounds like I'm cheering for a Civil War, but I just can't get away from this idea that we're headed for a Civil War. I really can't. I really can't. I hope I'm wrong. I hope to God I'm wrong, but it's just... When I see this, I just see the divide is too much, and it's scary, man. Well, thank you for listening, and hopefully you're not too scared from the things that I said this episode or anyone else said. We always appreciate when you click play and listen and participate in the show. Thank you to our Liberty.me listeners. We love you, libertarians. I think we hit a point we're all going to agree on today with our post office discussion. As always, if you want to hit up some merch, you can go to themidside.com/store. I'm going to be adding a new t-shirt there, a few new t-shirts over the next couple months. I'm working on a design right now, and I'm also going to throw up some designs based on my book cover, The Cut. If you want to join us in Discord, you can do that. Just go to themidside.com/podcast, click on any episode link, and you can join our Discord server there and talk with us during the week. As always, you can support us on Patreon per episode or locals per month. That's themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/locals. That is how we keep the lights on. Or I just had to, you know, re-up with our web host. So I was able to afford that thanks to you all. So thank you for helping us keeping this show going. And as always, the number one thing you can do is you can tell a friend. Tell a friend about everything we talked about this week and how we're not trying to divide people. We're trying to unite people based upon their actual human experience. And holy shit, Dan, this goes to something you said earlier in the episode. It's so weird to me that we've now flipped things around in that way. My whole life I was told, well, people like you are the ones who want to divide people, and we need to unite based on our human experience. But really, really, that's what we're trying to do here in the Midside, is unite people based upon their true human experience as individuals. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emblesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have an individual identity. So, Justin, I'm so desperate for sci-fi, I've been rewatching old Farscape episodes. And, man, is it good? But it's very TV, man. It's very talky, right? It's a little different than what we've been seeing lately. It's refreshing in a little way, but I find myself sometimes, my mind a little wandery because of how talky it is.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things The Expanse excelled at, is it's not just a talky show.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely something I'm looking forward to for the new season of Expanse.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe that's what I think I just kind of nailed what I didn't like as much about season 4. It was a little more talky, I think. So, thanks.